Hey, serious privacy enthusiasts. Ready to ace your AI data privacy game?
Oh, you bet, Kay. Dive into the world of TrustArc's Nemity Research, your go-to for staying on top of regulatory developments in AI and privacy.
Seriously, Nemity Research maintains a massive privacy and regulatory database featuring expert guidance and analysis from legal and privacy pros.
So save time on privacy research, cut your compliance timeline, and reduce costs with Nemity Research.
Get your regulatory research and insights at your fingertips with a free trial.
So get ahead in privacy compliance and start that free trial today. Go to trustarc.com/nimity-free-trial.
You're listening to Serious Privacy by TrustArc. Please welcome our hosts, Paul Breitbarth and Kay Royal.
On 29 and 30 September, senior representatives of the United States and European Union, including the likes of Commission Executive Vice President Margrethe Vestager and U.S. Secretary of Commerce Gina Raimondo, are to meet in Pittsburgh during the new Trade and Tech Council. Not on the agenda, but at the same time very much on the agenda, the transatlantic data protection deal to replace the privacy shield that many of you are waiting for. With Washington claiming a deal is close and Brussels disagreeing, some in-person conversations seem to be in order. Still at the core of the debate, the application of U.S. surveillance laws to data originating in Europe. Our guest today knows all about these laws. Caroline Lynch, the founder and owner of Copperhill Strategies, has 15 years of Capitol Hill experience, including a decade with the House Judiciary Committee, where she served for 8 years as the chief counsel of the Subcommittee on Crime, Terrorism, Homeland Security, and Investigations. As chief counsel, Caroline was at the forefront of developing some of the most high-profile privacy, cybersecurity, national security, and criminal laws of the 21st century in the US, and she authored dozens of pieces of legislation, developed strategies to successfully shepherd those bills through Congress. So what can she tell us about these laws, how they apply, and to what extent they may be misunderstood in Europe? My name is Paul Breitbart.
And I'm Kay Royal, and welcome to Serious Privacy. So Caroline, thank you so much for coming on and joining us. This is one of my contacts. She and I were in law school at the same time, but in different classes. So we kind of knew each other in passing at the point, but gotten to know her a lot better since she returned to Arizona. She has come and spoken at several of my privacy classes. So I know what she has to share is going to be highly, highly informative and fun. I mean, that's the other thing, and fun. Right, Caroline?
Absolutely. Thank you, Kay and Paul. It's fun to be here.
Beautiful. So, unexpected question. What's the most valuable thing you own? And you're not allowed to say a car or a house.
Oh my goodness. The most valuable thing I own. That's a tough question, Kay. Oh my gosh.
They're never easy.
I'm racking my brain through all my material possessions. And
well, if that helps you, honestly, some of my questions, my answers, because this comes from a book with, you know, an answer for each year. So 5 years worth. My prior answers were my memories of things.
Oh, okay.
Invaluable things. My love from pets, my family, probably not the family loyalty, but family head loyalty. Still the things that are probably, it wasn't until the last year that I actually put an entry in for material things, but it's
okay.
Quite a story.
Great. Well, then I would definitely start with my family. It's at the top of my list and a big reason why after 15 years in Washington, D.C., I was ready to come back to Phoenix as all my family is here. And I'm one of those rare species. I'm a native Phoenician.
Ooh, I don't think I ever knew that.
Right? And even today, for our generation especially, that's a rare find. So
everyone's from Chicago, New York, or California.
Right, exactly.
So, wow.
Yeah, you stumped me out of the gate, Kay. Now I'm a little nervous.
Everyone says they're always prepared for it, and they're never prepared for it.
Never prepared. No.
Well, I would choose material things, but they are two things, actually, that are very dear to me because of their emotional value. And the first is the statue that we actually discussed before.
Yes.
That I got from my parents, by Kate Kovitz, which represent a lot of the family history and family discussions and also the shared love of my parents and myself for European integration. The second is the only piece of jewelry I'm wearing. It's a family heirloom ring with the coat of arms of my great-grandmother on it.
Very cool. Well, I will say that my most valuable things are probably what have come to be known as Kay's Follies. And I'm a very cheap. I worked hard for my money and I don't like to let go of it. But every now and then I get a wild hair, typically on vacation somewhere, and I'm like, I gotta have it. So I have one of these necklaces from one of the islands in the Caribbean that I paid way too much for. And I have a vase, an Italian handmade vase from an art gallery in Vegas. I swear the thing was $5,000 or something. And my family's like, why? It's beautiful. What can I say? And they're like, none of us want this when you die, Mom. Not to mention the Betty Boop collection and, you know, all the bobbleheads and things. We won't go there.
So I guess in the end, it comes down to memories.
I'm learning all sorts of things about Kay on this call already.
Yeah, Caroline's like, I'm not sure I'm ever coming to speak in her class again. So
I'll just bring it up the next time I guest lecture for you, Kay. I'm going to review on Betty Boop.
I am a big Betty Booper. I am a huge Betty Booper. Okay, Paul, what's our first question? Hit us with it.
I think the main question is just asking Caroline, what was it like to work on the Hill discussing all these bills and making sure they went into law? I mean, I have a background in Parliament myself, so I have an understanding of the Dutch legislative process, but I also know that the U.S. process, we have discussed it quite a few podcasts by now, the U.S. process is so much different and so much more partisan and maybe less compromise-oriented than is our tradition here in Europe, so...
They don't understand the word compromise.
Tell us more about the experience.
Okay, the answer to this question could take up the entire podcast, so I'll try not to do that. I think it would help to start with explaining when I entered the arena of foreign intelligence collection and when that became part of my job. It was in 2006. So by the time I joined the House Judiciary Committee, the Patriot Act was already enacted. It had been for 5 years. So I entered the scene right at the time of the first reauthorization of the Patriot Act. And then I'm there for the subsequent reauthorizations for the FISA Amendments Act, which houses Section 702 and a lot of the controversy surrounding Privacy Shield. And then also for the Snowden leaks. So my tenure was 2006 to about 2016. And I think the main observations I would make is, first of all, simply because somebody has been elected to Congress does not make them a subject matter expert really on anything. Right. And it's why we have professional staff like myself who are there from 1 year to the next, from one Congress, so that we can provide the legislative history, the legal expertise, the context surrounding any issue, whether it's something controversial like intelligence collection inside the United States or any other subject. And part of the challenge for surveillance laws in particular is every 2 years we have a new freshman class. So every time the Patriot, or now the USA Freedom Act is really what those provisions are housed under, every time they come up for reauthorization, you have some universe of newly elected members who weren't in office the last time we did it. And even for the members who were there the last time, they probably don't remember what we tried to teach them, or they may not have availed themselves of, for example, the classified briefings, right? So In the universe of foreign intelligence collection, as a staffer, I had a security clearance. I could brief members on some things in a public setting, but if you wanted to take a deep dive into what the programs were operated under those authorities, you really needed to avail yourself of a classified briefing. Some members did, some members didn't. And that was always a challenge, is there's a spectrum of engagement and a spectrum of knowledge and then turnover. The other thing I would say that was also a tremendous challenge is the sunsets themselves. I have very mixed emotions about sunsets in any context, but particularly with regard to our intelligence gathering authorities, because Congress is notoriously bad at dealing with deadlines or timelines. And we need look no further than this coming Thursday, when we may or may not experience a partial government shutdown because of failure to fund the government into the new fiscal year. So,
which seems to happen more and more often. So,
and I think that's part of my concern with it, Kay, is it becomes built into the psychology. You'll notice in the context of funding the government and the debt ceiling, the House and Senate didn't really start paying attention to that till about a month ago.
Right.
And we've known it was coming for months. And the same is true in the Patriot Act or FISA Amendments Act context is, you know, we give ourselves 4 or 5 years of a reprieve. And at the staff level, we do our best to raise our hand early and say, by the way, this is coming. But Congress likes to pay attention to what is the headline du jour. To yes. What is an issue du jour. And oftentimes we found ourselves having to do a temporary extension for a week or two, or even in some instances, the authority is expiring altogether, which is what happened about 18 months ago, is the remaining temporary provisions of the Patriot Act expired 18 months ago in the midst of what we all call Russiagate and the pending IG investigation and the Durham investigation. So, you know, Paul, all this to say, it was very stressful. I will say we ultimately found that compromise. I mean, the USA Freedom Act is a law that I'm happy to help dissect all of the pros and the cons of it. But it took 2 years from the Snowden leaks in June of 2013, almost to the day, to June of 2015 before a bill was sent to the president. But those 2 years were spent negotiating between the House and the Senate and amongst Republicans and Democrats. And for better or for worse, we got to a bill. And so it does happen, but it is arduous, to say the least.
And then just when you got that work done on the USA Freedom Act, mere weeks later, the European Court of Justice came with the Schrems 1 ruling.
Right.
How did that land in Congress?
You know, honestly, I think Congress did not have the bandwidth to have to deal with that issue again on the heels of just having dealt with it. It, you know, Congress has a bandwidth and has an attention span, oftentimes of a 4-year-old. And so, at this point, members of Congress are just like, I don't want to talk about that anymore. I've moved on to what the other major topics are that are facing Congress right now or my constituents. And it's also, on that point, it's a very hard issue to explain to your constituents. I mean, whether and to what extent our own government spies on people inside the United States, that's a conversation that your constituents probably want to have and can grasp. But when you start talking about Schrems and Privacy Shield and, you know, what the European Union thinks of how surveillance laws apply to their citizens, I mean, most constituents either don't care or it's just so abstract for them that it doesn't become a priority for the members of Congress because it's not a priority for the constituents.
Well, and that's something that I was reading of an article on Kyrsten Sinema this morning about how politics used to be about your constituents that got you elected. Now it's not. Now it's national issues. And it's interesting how people fall on either side of the line when it comes to that, because a lot of the national issues you deal with, your constituents don't care. They don't know. They don't care. They don't understand. They have no interest in it in whatsoever. But yet it's something that you've got to make a decision on and you've got to either support or go against. And this is one of those issues.
It is. And it's interesting because oftentimes members of Congress will nationalize a local issue because their constituents don't necessarily appreciate the distinction between where state lawmaking or even local city or county lawmaking comes into a play versus federal lawmaking.
Yeah.
So I can't tell you the number of times I had to explain to a member of Congress that we won't create a federal theft statute, because unless that theft occurs within the jurisdiction of Congress, namely the Commerce Clause, it's a local issue. But the constituents bring that issue to their member.
They want it fixed. The member wants to make their constituents happy.
Absolutely.
And you're sitting there going,
absolutely. But it also breeds a lot of the misunderstanding in Congress about exactly what FISA in particular is, what it does and what it doesn't do, and under what criteria, you know, what are the procedures. And so when the Snowden leaks occurred, specifically when that happened, obviously there was a lot of very sudden and immediate outrage over the bulk telephony metadata program. And, you know, the easy answer, the outcry that is often accompanies concerns about privacy is you should slap a warrant requirement on it, right? I mean, and that's just kind of, I think it's the, pardon the expression, I think it's the poor man's solution to privacy is, well, it should just have a warrant. And if it doesn't have an American-styled probable cause-based warrant, then it couldn't possibly satisfy either constitutional protections or any other privacy strictures. Mm-hmm. So immediately the public and therefore members of Congress react viscerally to the telephony metadata program, maybe less so to PRISM and the 702 programs, again, because it's a little bit more abstract and hard to understand what that program was doing. And their immediate solution to the telephony metadata program is to impose a warrant requirement on it, which, I mean, Congress could write that, but, you know, to put it bluntly, that wouldn't make sense, right? It just wouldn't fit under the interpretation of the Fourth Amendment or what we've done in the past when it comes to metadata collection. So
what is the solution then, Caroline, with the tensions between Europe and the U.S. right now on government surveillance, this in particular being a key issue? What's the solution?
Oh, gosh. Well, I will say if I had the solution, I would be phoning in from my very large yacht right now, which I'm not. I'm going to go back to education. I'm going to go back to, you know, I have not been on the inner workings of, you know, the bilateral conversations. I don't know exactly how much time American intelligence agencies have spent walking through all of the procedures that accompany particularly 702 collection. But I do think that America has spent a lot of time apologizing for those procedures rather than necessarily holding them out as perhaps the most strict in the world. I mean, from where I sit, again, I'm out here in Phoenix, Arizona, but from where I sit, a lot of the European countries who make a part of the objections to Privacy Shield and whose membership is participating in these conversations about what that next iteration of that is going to be, do not have intelligence collection procedures that come anywhere close to what the United States has in place. As first of all, a dedicated court made up of independent members of the federal judiciary, the auditing procedures, the inspectors general housed inside each agency, the foreign intelligence information litmus test. I mean, I could tick off, you know, a whole list of the things that make up the entire universe of intelligence collection when they pertain to foreign nationals. And I don't think that I'm not aware of a system that is comparable or exceeds that. And so the other thing I will just throw into the mix, which I, in my sense, is kind of the elephant in the room that nobody's talking about, is there's a vast amount of tension, 702. And 702, for your listeners who may not appreciate what I'm talking about, right? This is this addition to FISA created by the FISA Amendments Act in response to a FISA court opinion. And I won't bore you with the details of the court opinion, but essentially Congress was confronted with a bit of a conundrum on collection of intelligence when at least one of the targets was outside the United States, but the communication flows through the United States. So 702 was created because, for better or for worse, American telecommunication companies have spent billions of dollars over the last four decades laying the fiber optic cable that transmits the bulk of our international telecommunications data. And so there's a lot of focus on 702, that section of that title created in 2008, and the extent to which it's used when a foreign national is the target of intelligence collection. What I see less of a conversation of, and again, maybe I'm just not in the thick of it, is the intelligence collection that happens under EO 12333, And again, for your listeners, EO 12333 is the umbrella executive order that governs.
That's also in TRIMS too. Let's be clear. It was FISA 702 and executive order 12333.
Right. 12333 is outside of the, to the extent collection occurs under 12333, it is outside the confines of any FISA court review. And so I do think, you know, it's in the mix, but I find it interesting that 702 seems to be a larger object of scrutiny, at least from my perspective. So
where to start? there are a few things in response. Caroline, also for your information, when I was with the Dutch DPA until 5 years ago, this was my final file, the response to the Schrems 1 decision and the assessment of the privacy shield.
You dropped it and walked out?
I dropped the opinion and walked out. Yeah, basically. And the opinion said, no, we are not ready yet to sign an agreement. And the European Commission did. There were quite a few briefings from the US sides with details on the various programs. And I think a lot of people who are involved in this appreciate how thorough the system is set up. And I don't believe the objections are that the US does intelligence gathering for national security purposes. I don't believe that the objections are that information on foreign nationals is collected. When I look at the way Europeans and the European courts look at all of these issues, it is mainly on oversight and redress. And yes, there is a very thorough oversight mechanism that is set up. But as an individual from Europe, I have a very hard time to get any information out of the US on whether I am actually part of that surveillance, yes or no, whether my fundamental right to privacy and data protection have been infringed. And I cannot go to court because the FISA court is there, but it is a secret court. It meets behind closed doors. Nobody is aware that it meets. And also the rulings are confidential or even state secret, which makes it very hard for us Europeans to have a good understanding of what data might be impacted, how might it be impacted, and to get any type of individual redress. And I think that is the main concern that hopefully will be addressed now in the negotiations that are still ongoing, where I still don't understand why it's Commerce taking the lead in those negotiations and not DNI or Homeland Security.
Well, I think, so just jurisdictionally, I think Commerce will always be the tip of the spear, even if ODNI and to some extent NSA or the Justice Department are also participants. When it comes to anything that is bilateral or multilateral or trade related, you know, you're looking at Commerce and State, obviously, as your main diplomatic negotiators and conduits. I appreciate the concern about individual redress, and I think it's part of the fundamental difference between how Europeans view the right to privacy versus how Americans view it. Now, Americans, I think, are evolving to view privacy perhaps more akin to how the European community has embraced it. And that's why you see CCPA or CRPA now, you know, creating GDPR-esque levels of individual redress. I think that my hunch is that the challenge is, first of all, intelligence gathering, whether we like it or not, has to happen in secret. One of the things that I had struggled with as a congressional staffer for so many years is the criticism of the FISC as a secret court. And my answer is, well, we don't spy in public. No country, be they European, part of the European Union or the United States or China or anybody else, spies in public. The second thing that I point out when talking to folks about the status of the FISA court is the FISC should be viewed not as a court of redress. I frankly would oppose creating redressability rights within the FISC because that's not...
I agree.
Yeah, the FISC is a classified magistrate. So in the U.S. system, in the U.S. federal system, applications for electronic surveillance, applications for search, applications for any kind of, you know, information in the criminal context are heard ex parte before a federal magistrate without the target of the investigation aware that the application has been made or issued. So in that, if you view the FISA court through that lens, then there really is no difference between the FISA court and a criminal magistrate when it comes to, again, an application for a wiretap. Whether it's a Title I FISA court order or it's a Title III criminal wiretap, the government went to a court behind closed doors, demonstrated what the law required, and was given an order to listen to phone calls or read emails. To your point, where those two things diverge is when does somebody become aware of that surveillance and what can they do about it, right? Mm-hmm. And so, again, back to the point I made just a minute ago, when that redressability becomes an issue in the criminal context, it's typically no longer with the magistrate necessarily, right? We've now moved up to into the federal district court system and beyond. And I think the same would be true in the FISA context, is that, first of all, there's a question as to whether the surveillance was actually authorized by the FISA court, depending on the source of the surveillance. And second of all, the FISC is meant to be an ex parte magistrate issuing intelligence collection orders. So I'm curious to see if the conversations going on right now are looking to the federal district courts for the source of redressability, to the extent a court is the first place you go. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also should be a part of the conversation is when, you know, I'm sitting here in Phoenix and I could probably come up with, I could question whether I've ever been the target of some sort of intelligence collection, whether it was because as a congressional staffer, I spoke on the phone with somebody who was under surveillance and therefore my conversations were looped in, or because I'm just sitting here in my home wondering whether I've ever been the target of surveillance.
But if I have that question, I can just write a letter to the review board for our intelligence services and ask, have I been the target of surveillance? And if that surveillance is not ongoing, then they will be able to give me an answer. And they may be able to confirm that there was surveillance. There, in some cases, in some member states, there is also the obligation to notify people ex post, so when it's over, and especially when there was no reason to prosecute you. So those options exist, and only in a final instance you get to the level of the courts, which, again, as a European, would be difficult in the US because it is very hard to get standing.
Absolutely. And so I guess the question is, what does one do in the European context armed with an answer that says, yes, at some point you were the subject of surveillance, but it's closed and nothing came of it? What happens next?
Would you agree with the proposal made by Professor Peter Swire that there could be a larger role for the privacy and civil liberties oversight officers in the various intelligence agencies to review that information?
Sure. I mean, I think whether it's the privacy officers or the inspectors general, you know, there's quite a few different mechanisms inside some of these agencies where they could provide an assessment of it. I guess my question is are we starting from the presumption that because a European citizen was the subject of surveillance and let's say nothing came of it, that surveillance was then inherently incorrect?
No.
Okay.
No, that would not be my assumption.
Right.
So I think what I would be looking for is for the confirmation that if there was any surveillance taking place, that it was done in accordance with the law and with the agreements between the United States and the European Union.
Okay. So does it need to actually then, because the challenge is going to be, I think, from the position of the United States, and we've seen this in the no-fly context, right? To back up for a second, you know, the no-fly list, part of the larger terrorist watch list operated by the FBI and other agencies here in the United States, individuals, the issue of redressability on no-fly has been the subject of litigation for years. And the challenge has been that American intelligence agencies are loath to tell somebody that they have been the subject of intelligence gathering, not necessarily because they're concerned that they were casting too wide of a dragnet, but because intelligence gathering is imperfect in by design, mm-hmm. right? So somebody who is flagged as a potential ISIS sympathizer or who is otherwise either, you know, the subject of surveillance or put on a no-fly and nothing comes of it is the, in the sense of a criminal prosecution, because that's usually what we want to see. We want to see intelligence gathering result in a criminal prosecution. And if it doesn't, then our I think our natural inclination is to question the veracity of the intelligence gathering. Well, I think the intelligence community would tell you, no, there's quite a bit of intelligence that we collect that is valuable that may not become actionable in the sense of punishment or some other, you know, more tangible result. But in those situations, in the no-fly context, it's been the question of when somebody should know that they were put on the no-fly list and why, and what the vetting process was to remove them from the no-fly list, I don't think is simply black and white in the sense of, well, nothing ever came of it, right? Nothing, you know, no, criminal prosecution, no other punitive measure, no other result came of it. So therefore, the intelligence gathering must have been faulty in some way, right? And now the person should know that they were under government surveillance and, you know, that there could be a concern they would change their behavior accordingly. And again, because intelligence gathering is a different kind of art form and is by design imperfect, is there a possibility that either that American citizen on no-fly or a European citizen who would want to be notified is nonetheless still potentially a bad actor, and we've just told them that they were under American surveillance? I don't, you know, so I don't know that. Clearly, I don't have all the answers to what.
Or do I? Otherwise, right. I would have had that yacht.
I had the answer, but I just forgot it.
Oh, no. Yeah.
And Caroline, I appreciate your honesty and your openness on these topics. And the courts also have not made it easy. They have a very strict interpretation of our fundamental rights. At the same time, they are our fundamental rights, which are in all of our founding treaties, both nationally, well mainly internationally, both European Union and Council of Europe. And we'll just have to make do with them. Like, you have to deal with the US Bill of Rights, which just lines out what you need to do. And somewhere we will need to find a solution while also not limiting the national security capabilities of the various countries too much, because we both need the intelligence gathering as well to keep our nations secure.
Yeah. And if I can just add one, you know, maybe final thought to that notion is what I wouldn't want to do is to create a notification system or a redressability system that becomes as ubiquitous as the cookie notification. Mm-hmm. It needs to be meaningful. It needs to not overwhelm the system, right? Such that the requests for information actually kind of, you know, swallow the whole. But I think we've seen in other privacy contexts where notifications or information to empower the individual have become a little bit of white noise in the background. I don't know about you, but at least for me, right. If, you know, I get a dozen cookie notifications a day, and I don't know about you, but I click accept every single time because I'm like, I don't care, whatever, just cookie me. So to that point, Paul, I would want that procedure to be well defined and substantive and not overwhelm the system.
No, and I think we also agree there. And to be bluntly honest, I don't believe that a lot of people actually do have the interest, whether they are being surveilled or not. I mean, even the procedures that did exist under the Privacy Shield have hardly been used in practice. Right. We also should be honest about that. This is largely a theoretical discussion, but because it is at the core of our fundamental rights protection, it is so important to do it right. And of course, this is a bit of a three strikes you're out kind of discussion. We have had two major court cases annulling a deal between the US and the European Union. We cannot have that a third time around.
Right.
And I'm really curious to see what may happen, what could come out of these conversations. Set, it's not on the agenda for Pittsburgh this week. but it certainly is on the agenda in the back rooms.
I was going to say, I'm sure it's intentionally not on the formal agenda, right? but
it only would have been on the agenda if there was something to announce.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
I don't think there's an easy answer.
Any questions
here.
You have?
No, I don't. It's just, you know, it's frustrating that there's no easy answer.
Yep.
And there's not on any side of it, not for any government body, not for any level of constituents. There's no easy answer here. The best we can hope to do is try to understand what the interests are on both sides of and find a compromise. Although I don't believe we're ever going to really find a compromise. It's going to be interesting to see what the outcome's going to be if there isn't.
I agree.
I fully agree. And on that note, we are at the end of another episode of Serious Privacy. Thank you all for listening. If you like our series, please do tell your friends and colleagues about us and rate and review our episodes in your favorite podcast app or on your favorite podcast platform. Should you have any questions or suggestions, please reach out to us via seriousprivacy@trustark.com or via Twitter @podcastprivacy. You'll find us also on LinkedIn. Just look for Serious Privacy. You will find Kay on Twitter as Heart of Privacy and myself as Europol B. Until next week, goodbye.
Bye, y'all.
That was Serious Privacy.
Hey listeners, looking to navigate the realm of responsible AI data privacy governance? Well, look no further.
Absolutely. TrustArc is paving the way, offering a complete approach to managing privacy risks in the world of AI.
TrustArc allows organizations to confidently use AI with personal or sensitive data, moving forward efficiently and cost-effectively.
And here's the kicker. Protect your company and data with TrustArc's privacy-driven compliance software.
Because they're deep automation streamlines data privacy governance, cutting your time to compliance with automated data mapping, risk assessments, and regulatory reporting.
TrustArc's enhancements go way beyond that, helping organizations understand AI better and align cross-functionally on data governance, privacy, and security.
Plus, they provide guidance on privacy governance for AI and how to mitigate risks using frameworks like NIST AI, OECD AI, and the NIMACY Privacy Management Accountability Framework.
If you're aiming for compliance excellence, check out Privacy Central, seriously one of my best parts. It uses automation and privacy expertise to understand your requirements, build and manage your privacy program with ease.
Oh, I agree. Privacy Central is your go-to to measure your progress toward responsible AI data compliance.
Stay ahead with TrustArc's Privacy Central. Visit TrustArc.com now. Ask me and Paul if you have any questions.